Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Stephanie Curtis, sitting in for Carrie Miller. This hour, we're going to take a closer look at three countries around the world. We'll discuss Germany and Chancellor Merkel's inability to form a government since September's election. Venezuela has had a tumultuous year and in the past few months has descended into a true humanitarian crisis. But first, a country with a chance of sweeping change, Zimbabwe.
Bulawayo, and we did not want Mugabe at all. He's the one who engineered the Gukurahundi. We were tired of this man. We are so glad he's gone. We don't want him anymore. And yes, today it's victory. It's victory in our hearts. It's victory for our children. And it's totally normal. I'm so sorry.
It's okay. We understand. I think you're allowed to cry okay. On a day like this. I think pretty much everybody in Zimbabwe is crying at this moment.
That is the sound of a joyful woman celebrating the end of Robert Mugabe's rule, which had begun in 1980. Joining me now to discuss Zimbabwe's future is Peter Godwin. He's an award-winning foreign correspondent. He's an author, documentary maker, screenwriter, and was born in Rhodesia, which is what Zimbabwe essentially became. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks.
That woman we heard in the clip saying it's a victory, you know, what changes are she and other Zimbabweans hoping for? What kind of victory are they looking for?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I think what you saw on that day that Mugabe was put under house arrest and where the army came into the cities and there was, in fact, whatever you call it, a coup, was just an enormous relief that after 37 years, Robert Mugabe was gone. And, you know, it's hard to exaggerate the effect that one man could have had on a country. That was almost like the country was being held hostage, that this one person's this dead hand of stasis was sort of on the throat of this country for so long. And so initially, I think people were just, you know, myself included, just absolutely giddy with the kind of just the fact that he was finally, that he wasn't there anymore, and grateful to whoever had engineered that situation. The problem with the sort of optics of what you saw and the way that the media covered it, I'm not criticizing the media, but was that you saw jubilant crowds in the streets, you saw interviews like the one you just heard, and you could be forgiven for thinking that this was some sort of a bottom-up revolution, which in fact it wasn't. It was a top-down one.
Yeah. I neglected to give out the phone number, and I want to do that in case people have some questions about what's happening in Zimbabwe. Our phone number is 651-227-6000 or toll-free 1-800-242-2828. As you said, it was top-down, and so the new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, I practiced that a little bit. How did I do?
Mnangagwa.
Ah, there we go. He was, in fact, I mean, he was a number two, and he was expected to take over after Mugabe at one point. And he, in like 2008, he put together waves of deadly violence to tamp down the opposition. What's been happening since he took over?
I mean, it's very early days, and here's the problem that the opposition face, and here's the problem in a sense that all of us face while looking at this kind of new regime, what some in Zimbabwe are already calling the junta, is that, you know, to some people they think, well, whatever their origins and whatever their resumes, and their resumes are not good, their resumes are the same as Mugabe's, mm-hmm. That they should be given a chance, that they're making the right noises. Mnangagwa is visiting South Africa at the moment, and he's saying we're open for business. And what he has already done and what you can expect to see more of is that he's presenting himself as a reformer. He's presenting the ruling party, ZANU-PF, which Mugabe used to head and Mnangagwa now heads, as a sort of reformed entity, you know, ZANU-PF 2.0, ZANU-PF 3.0, whatever, that it's kind of going to be modern and business-minded, and that he's also promising free and fair elections later this year. They're due in constitutional terms before August. But you know, we've heard all of this before from the ruling party, and they've never delivered. So there's an enormous amount of skepticism there too. So I think people are torn in Zimbabwe between giving Mnangagwa, you know, a chance, and those who say, no, what we're actually doing by giving him a chance is just helping the ruling party to go sort of seamlessly. It sort of had an internal coup from one old guard leadership to the next without the people being involved.
Let's go to the phone calls. Zainab in Minneapolis has a question. Hi, Zainab.
Hi. So my question is, does this new government mean a better life for the average Zimbabwean?
Thank you so much, Zainab. And if it did mean a better life, what would have to happen for it to mean a better life?
Well, it's an interesting question, isn't it? Because the one advantage you have when you inherit a country that is effectively a failed state. So the Zimbabwean economy is in such bad condition. There's soaring unemployment. Almost all manufacturing has stopped. Agriculture has been terribly disrupted. You know, everywhere you look, it's a country that's kind of that is a failed state. The one advantage coming in a situation like that is that there's really only one way to go, and that's up. That when something's that sort of destroyed, it's often relatively easy to start to fix it. There are certain basic things you can do. One of the big problems has been that it's massively corrupt. So if you look around in Zimbabwe, you'll see is, in common with a lot of countries like that are very poor overall, is a very, very wealthy elite at the top who are skimming everything off. And if they cut down on that, if they make it easier for businesses to open, if they guarantee property rights and that businesses feel that they can invest without having their investments ripped off, then I think you could see some improvement quite quickly to the lives of average Zimbabweans. I mean, just, you know, on one point, which may seem trivial to Americans, but, you know, is really crucial to Zimbabweans, is that until the coup, you know, for the last several years, you couldn't move more than a few hundred yards in Harare without coming across a police roadblock and be shaken down for a few dollars everywhere you went. And it was just, you know, it was tiresome, but for many people it was unaffordable. Those policemen disappeared, and the new government has promised that will no longer be the case. So that's one little example. And if you look at Zimbabwean social media, people are sort of immensely kind of grateful that those harassing police officers have gone.
Mnangagwa has put him as his vice president, one of the members of the military who helped him remove Mugabe. Is that alarming to Zimbabweans, or does that in fact seem like a stabilizing, acceptable thing to have happen?
You know, until this coup, or whatever we want to call it, the Zimbabwean army wasn't a kind of threat politically in the same way that you had coups in West Africa, for example, where the generals themselves, you know, end up being the presidents. That wasn't the case, and that's generally not been the case. If you look at all of the post-liberation war countries of Southern Africa, in other words, countries that have fought anti-colonial wars for independence, where those political movements that fought those wars then become the ruling parties, there's often very little to distinguish the civilian side of those parties from the military side. You can't really tell. They're all sort of essentially one monolithic institution. So that they've never been seen as a source of instability in that regard. However, what they have always been seen as, and what is now much more overt and explicit, if you like, is that they are now the guarantors of the ruling party's power. And so for opposition parties, what this means is that there's very little likelihood that an opposition party could ever win or be allowed to take office in Zimbabwe. And there's all sorts of code phrases that the armies and the generals use, things like, we have to defend the revolution. And what they mean by that is the ruling party. And it's worth noting that none of those ruling parties that have fought wars in Southern Africa have ever lost power, have ever lost an election. You can go from the MPLA in Mozambique, from the MPLA in Angola, to Frelimo in Mozambique, ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe, SWAPO in Namibia, ANC in South Africa. They're all still in power. And to that extent, what you see is General Chiwenga as Deputy Prime Minister would be an explicit reminder that the army backs Mnangagwa and backs the ruling party.
So there are opposition parties that have been around even under Mugabe's rule. Are they, I mean, even if the military and they have no chance, are they going to be vying for control? Is there if we had free and fair elections, would there be parties ready to take over in Zimbabwe that aren't part of this current ruling party?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Zimbabwe is an odd paradox in that it was a sort of explicit one-party state for some years, from sort of the mid-80s all the way through to kind of 1999. And then opposition politics burst out into the open again at that point. And in fact, you've got a sort of plethora of opposition parties at the moment, rather too many, because they split the opposition vote. But for some time, you had one very strong opposition party, the MDC, under Morgan Tsvangirai, and they won the first round of elections in 2008. They actually beat Mugabe. The ruling party kind of made an error in terms of their various vote rigging and whatever. But it's very instructive to note that what happened was that because they didn't win by enough of a margin, it was kicked into a second round. And between the first and second round, the army, many of them in civilian clothes, and the ruling party's kind of youth league and whatever, were deployed throughout the country, and they launched an appalling campaign of torture on an industrial scale, torturing opposition office bearers and members to such an extent that the opposition party didn't carry on, didn't contest the second round. There were 200 people, probably more than 200 people killed, and literally tens of thousands of people tortured. And the army was very much in, and Mnangagwa himself was very much instrumental in organizing that fight back. So let's not be under any illusions with what we're dealing with here. Mnangagwa was at Mugabe's elbow for many of Mugabe's 37 years in power. Mnangagwa was in almost every cabinet that Mugabe ever had. He was a minister. He was often a security minister, minister of defense, minister of he controlled the intelligence services, the very feared Central Intelligence Organization, the CIO. He was in charge of that at the time that Mugabe deployed his North Korean-trained 5th Brigade into the south of the country, and they killed probably more than 20,000 civilians back in the early and mid 80s. So that if you look at Mnangagwa on his resume, you don't have much to be encouraged by.
But there could be there will be elections this year. Whether they're free and fair or not is who knows. What are you going to be looking for to see, to be hopeful about? What do you want to see?
Well, this is a hard. I mean, I do think that Zimbabwe is so exhausted and fatigued by this sort of self-inflicted poverty and economic collapse that it's got to the point where nobody wants it to go on. That even the elite could make more money. Even the corrupt sort of element could look to make more money under a more vibrant economy. It's also possible that Mnangagwa is genuine when he makes the promises that he has. I mean, the cynic in me says he's already made so much money himself. Bear in mind that he is on a American and EU sanctions list himself for corruption, that he was very involved in when Zimbabwe went into the conflict in Congo. He was very involved there and made money out of that, and that's even in a UN report, et cetera. So everybody wants to kind of see Zimbabwe move on. It's possible. I think he may be encouraged by the fact that Cyril Ramaphosa has just won the ANC leadership contest in South Africa, which is by far Zimbabwe's most important trading partner and neighbor in general, and that Ramaphosa will probably back reforms in Zimbabwe to some extent too. So I think that he's made a lot of encouraging noises. He's reached out to the diaspora. There's this huge Zimbabwean diaspora as a proportion of the population, maybe a quarter of the Zimbabwe population has fled from the country. And among them, the most educated and skilled, are among them. And he's reached out to them. I mean, Zimbabwe to a great extent relies on the remittances of those those expat Zimbabweans, those the Zimbabwean diaspora, wherever they are in Europe and in Canada and in America and South Africa, they all send money home. And that's one of the reasons, you know, many, many Zimbabwean households survive on that. There's a question of whether the diaspora should be allowed to vote. They haven't been allowed to vote so far, and whether they should get the vote, that's a big a question. Mnangagwa has made noises about returning some of the property to commercial farmers, to white farmers, mostly who had their farms seized by Mugabe. And some of those farms are just standing empty or unproductive or whatever, and that Mnangagwa has said that he can't have that, that those must be farmed by whoever, even if it's white commercial farmers. So that might see some sort of modest revival in the agricultural industry, for example.
Thank you so much for joining us, Peter Godwin, with this update on Zimbabwe. And I'm going to be interested to see what happens in the election in the next year. And we'll check in with you later this year to see what your thoughts are.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. Peter Godwin is a writer and filmmaker. He himself was born and raised in Rhodesia in Zimbabwe, and he joined me from New York. Venezuela has one of the largest oil reserves in the world, yet the economy is staggering. The last year has seen protests against the government that have been quashed, and the last few months have devolved into a humanitarian crisis. Joining me now is Danny Bahar, fellow at the Brookings Institution's Global Economy and Development Program. Welcome, Danny.
Hi, thanks for having me. Good morning.
So it's been quite a tumultuous year in Venezuela. There are protests in the streets against the Maduro government, and I've read vague references that Maduro has consolidated power over the last few months. What does that mean, and what's happened in the past year?
Well, there. I would say, to simplify the story for our listeners, there are two big sides to this story. There's a political crisis, and there's a huge economic crisis, and they, of course, both go together. So. Mm-hmm. Economically, I think it's fair to say that the Venezuelan economy is one of the most distorted economies in the world. There are many controls, and there has been a lot of mismanagement, which has caused, and a lot of corruption, of course, which has caused to the country to have hyperinflation. It's the highest inflation rate in the world. There's an stagnation. The country has lost about 30 to 40% of its GDP, of its production. There are people hungry in the street. There's lack of food. There's lack of medicine. People are dying from very preventable diseases. There's a statistic out there that says that 75% of Venezuelans have lost up to 20 pounds because of hunger. So it's a really humanitarian crisis. Started off with the drop in the price of oil. As you said before, Venezuela is an exporter of oil, but it's not because of the drop in the price of oil. You see, there are many other countries that export oil, but they aren't going through a humanitarian crisis. The reason for this crisis is a huge mismanagement of a government that has been in power for 20 years.
We're talking about Venezuela and the crisis there, economic and political. Our phone number is 651-227-6000 or call 1-800-242-2828. What kind of controls are you talking about? What is it? Has it changed since under Chavez, or is it the same controls that Chavez had?
Yeah, they started with Chavez. So there are a few controls in place. For instance, there's exchange control. Everybody who wants to buy foreign currency, they will have to go through the government. So this is not only about people who want to go on vacation, but this is about firms who want to import food. Mm. There's an official exchange rate, which is set by the government, which is highly undervalued. Every time you say in economics, every time you set a control on a price, a black market emerges. Mm-hmm. So as of now, the price of the dollar, which is the main foreign currency that you can think of, in the black market, it's about 10,000 times the official price of the dollar set by the government. So this is 10,000 times. So you can understand the magnitude of the distortion. And part of the reason of this whole crisis that we see today is actually that the country is highly indebted. This government, starting with Chavez, did exactly the opposite of when any economic student will learn in his or her first Economics 101 class, which is, when the price of oil was up and when the country was having a lot of income, instead of saving a little bit of that income for the bad times afterwards, they actually spent it all and they actually got much more debt. And when they basically were isolated from borrowing more money, they started printing money. So that's why we have inflation. So now Venezuela is on default. The country is not able to pay its external debt. And that, of course, has a repercussion on the ability of the country to import. And that's why people are hungry and are dying from diseases.
Do these who are the creditors? Which countries are the creditors? And would they have any ability to bring the country in line again?
Well, you know, in a normal country, we would have answers to all these questions. But a lot of this has been managed in a black box. So we don't really have official numbers for all of this. But we know that a lot of these creditors are actually people in Wall Street. So a lot of these were bonds, sovereign bonds of the government and also through the oil company, which is state-owned. So a lot of these is individuals or companies who bought bonds through Wall Street. But also a big chunk of it is China and Russia. What we're seeing now is we are in the middle of understanding how these dynamics are going to develop, given that the country has officially, in some of the debt, the credit rating companies have declared Venezuela in default. So we don't really know how this is going to end.
Is there any country that the Maduro government is still communicating with that they still, like, is Russia really in touch with them? Is China? Because the United States has cut off ties to Venezuela long ago, right?
Right. Well, the United States has an embassy there, but doesn't have an ambassador. So their diplomatic relations are very weak. And the United States in the past year, since President Trump stepped into power, they have been harsher towards Venezuela in implementing sanctions and so on and so forth. So, I mean, yeah, there's a group of countries that Venezuela is still speaking, even though it has actually been isolated from most countries in Latin America. Most countries in Latin America have expressed uncomfort with what has been happening on the political front, too. But I think that they still communicate with Cuba, which is their ideological brother. And they still communicate with China and Russia. But even though we know that the Chinese also has expressed concern about the debt and the payments that they own them. So it's not clear exactly how those relationships are happening behind closed doors, if they're warm or they're getting colder.
We have a call from Brian in Savage. He called 651-227-6000, or you can also call 1-800-242-2828. Hi, Brian. What was your question?
Yeah, I just wanted to hear his thoughts on the U.S.'s role, especially in the past decade or so, of making the humanitarian crisis even worse in Venezuela.
Thank you, Brian. Did we make it worse?
Well, Brian, thanks for your question. I don't think so. I mean, that's what the government has been saying. The sanctions that the U.S. has imposed, they only started a few months ago. And this crisis started back in the time. So a lot of this crisis can be explained by, as I said before, like a lot of mismanagement on the economic side of the economy. This is a government that has mismanaged the resources. There's plenty of evidence of very deep corruption happening at all levels of government. And since the government, when the price of oil went down, basically the dynamics were such that with the little inflow of foreign currency that was going into the country, they had to decide between either keep paying the debt to the people in Wall Street or putting the money towards imports for the people to eat and to have food. Because with all the other price controls, there's almost no productive sector in Venezuela to produce domestically. And this government made a clear choice, which is they kept paying Wall Street until 3 months ago when they couldn't anymore. So they are responsible for the fact that people are hungry and dying again from preventable diseases. They're responsible of this humanitarian crisis. The sanctions by the U.S. government that are recent, there are two kinds of sanctions. The first ones are personal sanctions. So they're actually sanctioning directly officials in the Venezuelan government that has been shown to be engaged in corruption, even in drug dealing. This stops them from enriching themselves using U.S. institutions. The other type of sanctions is that the U.S. has banned from the Venezuelan government to issue new debt. The debt that has been issued already, that can still be marketed and so on, but they cannot issue new debt. And, you know, that's an open discussion whether that is really affecting or not. But in my sense, like, if the vast majority of the problem has been caused by the mismanagement of the government and could have been easily solved. I don't want to say easily, but it could have been solved if they would have just followed the Constitution and allow a democratic process to keep happening.
I want to talk about that political process and the democratic process. But Peggy in Chanhassen has a question about humanitarian aid. Hi, Peggy.
Hello there. My question is about aid. My understanding is that the government is not allowing or admitting the necessity of humanitarian aid. Are there any aid organizations that are able to function within Venezuela, such as Doctors Without Borders? Is Cuba, is the ideologic brother, as you mentioned, is there aid coming from Cuba to the people of Venezuela?
Thank you, Peggy. Great question.
Thanks, Peggy. That's a good question. Well, on Cuba in particular, I think that the direction is in the other way around. I think that most of the aid is going from Venezuela to Cuba, even though Cuba is now, ironically, in a much better position. The Venezuelan government still gifts to Cuba 100,000 barrels of oil per day, which is really important for their economy. And it's just given basically as a gift with nothing in return, just because of an ideological connection. I'm not aware of humanitarian aid coming in big scale, precisely for what you said, that the government itself, they actually deny that there is a humanitarian crisis, and they have refused from other countries and from multilateral organizations to get in with aid. So probably there are things happening at a very small scale, and I think that there's a lot of Venezuelan migrants that are sending to their families cash or even medicines and so on, but it's not, I don't think it's in an organized way as it should be.
Maduro is in control. He's the leader of the country, but the National Assembly is actually held by the opposition, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. The opposition won by a landslide the National Assembly elections in late 2015.
Do they have any real power? Is this a dictatorship?
Yeah, no, they have very little power. If we are nice, I think that they have no power at all. And the reason, and I think that this is a dictatorship, as has been said by other countries in Latin America and their governments and the Organization of American States. The reason is that this government, their behavior shows that they're trying to do everything that they can, whether it's legal or not, to stay in power. So when the National Assembly took power in early 2016 with a super majority of the opposition, they understood that this was a big risk. So then they actually started using the justices in the Supreme Court, which were all of them aligned with the government, to basically invalidate every decision that was coming out of the National Assembly. Until the very end, when in this spring, as you said at the beginning, there were many protests in the streets because people were fed up and they started to going out on the streets. One of the reasons was that the constitution in Venezuela allows for a recall referendum. After half of the mandate of the president, the constitution allows to make a recall referendum so that people can decide to remove the president from power. And through the judicial system, the government basically denied this option. They found some lame excuse, and they said this referendum is not going to happen. And people got really upset. And afterward, the Supreme Court also nullified the National Assembly. And when that happened, that erupted in many street protests. And there was a lot of repression. There were more than 100 people who died on a day-to-day basis. And these protests ended in July when the government found a new solution to the crisis, which is instead of actually listening to the people and going to some sort of democratic process with general elections and to allow for a peaceful transition of power, they decided to create a constituent assembly. That is an assembly that will rewrite the constitution. Mm-hmm. So now there is in place an assembly which is completely owned by the government and Maduro himself, that it's in charge of rewriting the constitution. And while they do that, we don't know, that can take years. They have powers over every single institution in the country, including the National Assembly. So they have completely put the National Assembly on the side, and Maduro actually has control over all the powers in the country.
There are supposed to be elections this year, so you don't expect much of that, do you?
Well, there were two elections already this year in 2017, which were overdue. There was an election for governors in which, surprisingly enough, even though the government has 20% of popular support, they won around 80% of the governorships of the country. So that's when the opposition understood, some people say they understood it a little bit later in the game, that the whole system is fraudulent. And there is so much, there are so many things happening behind the backgrounds for people to change the voting before and during the voting, that the second set of elections that happened actually last Sunday were for city councils and mayors, and the opposition, most of the opposition decided, you know, we're not even going to participate. It doesn't make sense for us to participate because it's all fraudulent. And now the big question is, well, there is a presidential election that should happen in 2018.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of uncertainty because, you know, if the conditions don't change, if the opposition cannot assure that these elections are going to be free and fair, it might not make sense for them to participate. But on the other hand, that has a big trade-off, which is just to give up the power to Maduro again for another 8 years. So it's a very, very tough call for the opposition right now.
Where's the military in this? Are they with Maduro?
That's a great question, and that's a big black box. We don't really understand what's happening inside of the military, but I can tell you a few things. I mean, when you see from the outside, yes, the high level officials of the military are close to Maduro, and there's a lot of rumors, and I think even some evidence that a lot of the generals and high ranking officials are very involved in corruption. Many of them manage the food distribution in the country, and some people claim that many of them are also involved in drug dealing. So they have all the incentives for this government to remain in power. One interesting data point that I think it's actually crazy is that there are about 2,000, some people say between 1,500 and 2,000 generals in the Venezuelan army. That's more generals than the NATO countries combined. So it seems like this government knew, and they came from the military, not Maduro, but Chavez before him. I think that they know very much the insides of the military. So they created a structure of incentives inside that will diminish the possibility that sometimes they could do a coup against them.
How are Venezuela's neighbors reacting to this? Colombia has a long border, and it's quite porous. Are they threatened by the instability in Venezuela?
Well, I mean, they certainly been affected because one of the outcomes of this whole crisis is the huge outflow of people from Venezuela. Some people say, I mean, we don't really have exact numbers, but the estimate is that there are between 2 million to 4 million of Venezuelans abroad, living in exile or in the diaspora. It's a huge diaspora. A lot of them in the U.S. and of course a lot of them in Colombia and Brazil. And you see on the day-to-day basis people crossing the border to Colombia just to get food. So of course that is really becoming a concern that there could be the very first level of humanitarian crisis in terms of refugees. And of course Colombia and Brazil, which are the neighbors, the largest neighbors of Venezuela, they have to be very concerned about how to deal with it. And on a larger scale, I think that the continent, the vast majority of the countries of the continent, at least the ones that represent over 90% of the population of the continent, that have been very clear in condemning what has been happening in the government, partly through the OAS, the Organization of American States, in which its Secretary General, Luis Almagro, has been a great leader in really pushing for democratic reform in the country. But also the foreign ministers of most of the Latin American countries have gotten together in a few occasions and they have condemned the country. One of the problems that the OAS has in doing harsher things, the Organization of American States, is that there's a block of very small Caribbean countries, islands, who are still voting for Venezuela, and they're basically blocking any kind of resolution that will condemn the Venezuelan government. So it's a big number of countries, but in terms of population, it's a very, very small share of the population of the continent.
Danny Bihar, we have to move on now. Thank you so much for joining us and for giving us some perspective about what's going on in Venezuela.
Thank you so much for having me.
Danny Bihar is a fellow at the Brookings Institution's Global Economy and Development Program. He joined me from Washington, D.C. Now we are moving to Germany. In Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel has yet to form a government, despite her party having won elections in September. The latest hope is that her party, the Christian Democrats, will join with the Social Democrats. It's highly unusual for a country that is usually so steady, unruffled as Germany, to be making, to have such problems forming a government. To talk about it right now, joining me is Jeffrey Anderson. He's a professor at the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Welcome, Professor.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Let me give out the phone number because I bet people have questions. You have a question about Germany and the future of the European Union and how Germany affects that. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. So what kind of power sharing is Angela Merkel hoping to get with the Social Democrats?
Well, I mean, it would be a very similar arrangement to the previous coalition formula. Germany has been governed by a so-called grand coalition that brings together the two major center parties, the center-left party, the Social Democrats, and the center-right grouping, the CDU, Christian Democrats, and the Christian Socialist Union. Angela Merkel's basically presided over such a government for the last 8 years or so, and this would be a continuation of that formula, although it's not a formula that either party really wants at this stage, but it's the best they can hope for.
Yeah, what it worked for the past 8 years. What is it that they don't want to be? Why is there a barrier right now?
Well, it's a question of what happens in the broader dynamics of the party system and also the polity. You have two very large parties that differ on important issues, but they tend to set those differences aside in order to form a workable coalition. But that means a lot of important issues don't get addressed. It creates an opportunity for fringe parties and extremist parties to make political hay, and that's certainly what happened in this recent election in September. The extreme right party, the Alternative for Germany, or AfD, did extremely well. And the Linke party, the left party, although it probably undershot its hoped-for result, still garnered a significant number of votes. And so both of these major parties, and Angela Merkel in particular, are worried about another 4 years of polarization, which tends to come with these kinds of grand coalition arrangements.
What are the differences between the two parties? What does Merkel's party want? What do the Social Democrats want that they can't agree on?
Well, I think the big differences are in the area of asylum and refugee policy, where the Social Democrats tend to take a more forgiving attitude on that. Now, obviously, that's something that got Angela Merkel into trouble politically in the first place. Her actions in 2015 to essentially send a welcome signal to Syrian refugees fleeing the conflict there, although it was an incredibly statesmanlike thing or statesperson-like thing to do, and it did her a lot of credit in terms of her own moral coordinate system. It backfired politically, and in many ways, the losses that her party sustained in September can be traced back to those actions that she took. The Social Democrats, on the other hand, although they're certainly not interested in opening the gates, tend to take a more humanitarian approach to this issue. So there are differences there. There are differences over Europe and the approach that Germany ought to take, particularly when it comes to future steps toward integration, the strengthening of the Eurozone. Big differences between the two parties there. So there's a lot to discuss, and there's certainly no reason to think that at the end of the day, that this third iteration of the Grand Coalition is going to work. The Social Democrats in particular are extremely worried about another 4 years of drift. They were punished at the polls by their own electorate, worst ever electoral result in the history of the Federal Republic for the Social Democrats. And they see another 4 years in a Grand Coalition, or many in the party see another 4 years in the Grand Coalition as simply a continuation of their electoral slide. And so there's a lot of pressure from inside the party to not go in or to only go into a grand coalition on terms that are favorable to the Social Democrats. And that obviously sets it up for potential failure.
Is there any chance that Merkel will step down as leader of her party? Would that help if she steps down and takes all the punishment for opening up the doors in 2015, and then someone else can come in and bring the government together?
That's certainly hypothetically possible, and that might even open the way for a restarting of coalition talks with the Free Democrats and the Greens, the so-called Jamaica coalition, the black-green, yellow coalition. That fell apart several weeks ago. You could imagine a different leader of the CDU, creating more space for negotiation with those other two smaller potential coalition partners. It's hard to imagine Merkel being replaced by a more progressive, if I can use that term, candidate. In other words, one who's more or would lean more toward the kinds of issues that motivate the Social Democrats. If anything, she's likely to be replaced by a more hardline candidate. And there aren't that many to speak of. I mean, she's done an incredibly good job of clearing the field of potential competitors within her own party. So it's not at all self-evident who would step up to take her place or push her out. But if that were to happen, it's more likely to be someone from the harder line wing of the party, which makes negotiations with the Social Democrats even more difficult. So it's a difficult situation, no question about it. I tend to think the chances of a new election or a minority government going forward under Merkel's leadership are actually higher than a grand coalition, or
really,
for that matter, a return to the Jamaica coalition coming to pass.
You think there could be a new election?
There could be. I mean, it's certainly spelled out in the German constitution. There are provisions for that. It's rather complicated. It's certainly an outcome that neither major party wishes to contemplate at this point, because there's a real concern that the electorate will punish the dithering and reward the fringe parties even more. And there's real concern about, in particular, the extremist right-wing party, the AfD, profiting from a new election so soon after the last one.
Timothy Garton-Ash said that Germany likes to, quote, change through consensus, and that it's always been kind of slow-moving and not rushed to judgment time, kind of a country politically. But now it used to be four parties. Now there are seven parties. Is it a new political landscape, or are these it's going to continue to splinter into smaller parties, or can it go back to a time when there are the big, strong parties again?
I'm not sure there's a return to the kind of stability of the good old days of the three-party system, in which the Social Democrats, the Christian Democrats, Christian Socialist Union, and the FDP kind of ruled the roost. That said, I don't see any reason to believe that further fragmentation and polarization is in the offing. And this is one of the reasons why there was so much hope attached to an alternative to the grand coalition formula, because it would have placed the Social Democrats back in opposition and given them an opportunity to profile themselves. It would have made it much harder for the Alternative for Germany to take a prominent position in opposition and kind of drive the extremist debate. So, you know, there are concerns about where the votes are going from election to election. But, you know, if you take a step back and look at what's happening in Germany, it's a pretty comfortable situation, economically speaking, positive growth, people aren't exactly taking to the streets with, you know, burning torches, complaining about the quality of life or the, you know, or political instability. I think we're just looking at an extended period of deadlock. And what's likely to break it is a major concession, a political concession on the part of the Social Democrats to, for lack of a better alternative, go back into a grand coalition for the good of the country, but on terms that are acceptable to that party. Or a minority government that where Angela Merkel would proceed essentially vote to vote and cobble together majorities. She'd probably get a tacit signal from the Social Democrats that they would support the government on many issues, but there might be some red lines where she would not venture legislatively. And you could imagine an arrangement like that continuing for a couple of years. Then Angela Merkel steps down, new elections are called, and you have a potential for some kind of return to normalcy.
Has there been a minority party in control before? Minority government?
No, that would be unprecedented for at least post-war Germany. Yeah.
So what does this mean for the European Union?
Well, the situation as it stands now is that obviously there is a government in place. The Merkel, the Grand Coalition, so to speak, is carrying on in terms of the ministers who are in charge of things, including the Chancellor. And so Germany is still working at the European level.
Germany is not a failed state yet.
No, gosh, no. And I think any calls along those lines ought to be resisted. I mean, it is a very stable democracy. Things are working as outlined in their constitution. It's obviously new territory, and it is creating some uncertainty. Merkel is not able to take a strong stand on a variety of issues. She's not able to even contemplate accepting the hand of co-leadership from Macron in France, because she doesn't have a stable majority in Parliament. But that's not to say that there's a power vacuum or that Europe is sliding into the abyss. Quite the contrary. Things are getting done. Brexit is being negotiated. Germany is continuing to be an important force there. But you're not going to see any new initiatives. You're not going to see any ambitious initiatives undertaken unless and until there's a German government in place.
What are the top issues for German voters right now? Is it the United States? A lot of people are voting about immigration and the economy and jobs for Germans. What are their top issues?
Well, the top issue in the election was immigration. And there's a small dash of irony there in that, at least since the agreement between the European Union and Turkey last year in 2016, which basically stopped the flow of Syrian refugees into the European continent, Germany really has not been experiencing a flood of refugees as it was, say, in 2015. I think the concerns are, unease over that influx of immigrants who came in and refugees who came in 2015. What's going to be done with them? How are they going to be integrated? And also just unease about the future stance. I mean, everyone's well aware that tap can easily be turned on again if the agreement with Turkey were to falter or the situation in Syria were to somehow worsen. There's the prospect of economic migrants from northern Africa and even in the interior of Africa coming across the Mediterranean. So this is not a problem that's going to go away anytime soon. And so even if the pressure isn't on right now in terms of actual bodies entering the European space and entering Germany, it's not a hypothetical issue. And so the German public is very concerned about this. They're also concerned about the kind of integrity of the German economic model, and that's where the European issues come in. Macron in particular, but I would say also the Social Democrats have charted out a course that would require probably a more forgiving attitude by Germany on issues like debt and transfer payments within the European Union. And that's something that politically is very difficult for Merkel to contemplate. Her political base, as well as the political bases of other parties in the system, especially the AfD, are very much opposed to any kind of check writing campaign for the Germans to underwrite what they see as a suspect political mission at the European level.
Well, how does this affect the United States' relationship with Germany?
Well, that's another point of uncertainty and even contention. I think for many Germans, for many Europeans, the Trump presidency represents the fifth crisis or challenge to wash over Europe since 2008. You had the Eurozone crisis, followed by the crisis in eastern Ukraine, a security crisis on Europe's borders propelled by Russia. You then had the refugee and the immigration crisis of 2016, and then you had Brexit as well. And now Trump. And Trump has injected a great deal of uncertainty into our transatlantic relationship, calling into question the basis of our trade relations with Europe, and in particular singling out Germany for criticism, referencing bad Germans who sell us too many automobiles and need to rectify our trade imbalance with Germany. He's also called into question the U.S. commitment to NATO repeatedly. None of this has been followed up with action yet, and so I think the Europeans are taking a kind of nervous wait-and-see attitude. But things are definitely looking much rockier today on the transatlantic scene than they were last year.
Jeff Anderson is a professor at the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio.